ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. Are we alphabet people, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, queer and asexual? Are we making enemies by having too good a time? As Mardi Gras looms, we're talking to Irish writer Ronan McRae about the backlash he fears is already underway, and not just in the United States. But first, foreign workers. We need them, but do we treat them right? The original notion was to bring workers in from the Pacific to do seasonal work in the bush, fruit picking and that sort of thing. And then these islanders began taking on hard-to-fill permanent jobs out there, mainly in abattoirs, also in nursing homes. So instead of going to and from Tonga and Kiribati and East Timor every year, many stayed on. The scheme, now called PALM, that stands for Pacific Australia Labour Mobility, is now a crucial source of workers across Australia, 32,000 of them. Peter Mayers, formerly of the ABC, wrote recently, "Beyond wages earned, jobs filled and diplomatic points scored, it also fosters cultural exchange and personal engagement, binding the peoples of Australia and the region more fully into a Pacific family." But PALM is dogged by reports of workers being abused, underpaid, and housed in substandard, expensive and overcrowded accommodation. Shortcomings that Peter has been investigating on behalf of the wonderful Scanlon Foundation. The result is a report just published called Improving PALM. Peter joins us now on Late Night Live. Welcome.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you.
Hey, what have you been doing since you left the ABC? A thumbnail, please. Bring us up to date.
Well, I left Radio National in 2011. Since then, I've written two books, one about temporary migration, not quite Australian, it was called, and another about housing, No Place Like Home. I've done a lot of other writing for Inside Story that I contribute to, and I've written another piece for Scanlon that was about parent migration. But none of that earns money, so mostly I've been working for the Cranlana Centre for Ethical Leadership, which is a not-for-profit organisation now associated with Monash University that runs programs in professional development programs, I guess, focused on ethics and leadership.
But for Scanlon, you looked at PALM. Now, Pacific workers is an old interest of yours, isn't it?
It is. Back in the early 2000s, or 20 years ago now, I had an Australia Research Council Industry Linkage Grant, as it was called. I was part-time at the ABC and part-time at Swinburne University back then. And I got this research grant to look into the feasibility of a seasonal labour program for Pacific Island workers, because we didn't have one back then. It first came in as a pilot scheme under Kevin Rudd in 2008 and was only confirmed as an ongoing scheme in 2012. So back then, 20 years ago, I did this research where I talked to farmers about their labour market needs. We surveyed them about their needs. I went to Canada and looked at their scheme, which brings workers from the Caribbean and Mexico. I had a colleague employed, Nick McClellan, a very experienced journalist, writer on Pacific Affairs, who travelled around the Pacific and talked to governments there. And basically we said we thought this was worth trying, worth piloting, and our work was presented at Senate committees and picked up by the World Bank and so on. And as I say, the Rudd government then decided to give it a go. And as you said in your introduction, it's now an established part of the rural labour market in Australia.
And it survived the coalition years unchallenged?
Well, no, quite the opposite, really. Under the coalition, there were a number of changes made to it to make it easier for farmers to use Pacific labour. So under the original scheme, employers had to contribute more to the cost of the workers coming to Australia. That was reduced. There was some other deregulation of the scheme under the coalition because the scheme didn't really take off. It was actually very small for a long time. Right up until COVID, it remained very small. There were only about 8,000 workers here prior to COVID. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is the other thing the Howard government had done in 2005 was to create an incentive for backpackers, working holiday makers, to work in jobs like this by offering them a second 12-month visa if they spent at least 3 months working in a job like fruit picking. So Palm and
with the wonderful name of doing your agricultural.
Well, I've heard it as 88 days a slave, actually, but, you know, we there were various forms that that's taken.
So islanders were working, the islanders as cheap labour were working against the backpackers as cheap labour.
Yeah, and I mean, I would be careful with the term cheap labour here because technically both working holiday makers and palm workers are guaranteed Australian award wages. And in fact, the palm scheme is much better policed and more highly regulated on that front than the working holiday maker program. So palm employers have to be approved by the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations. And, you know, not anyone can employ Pacific workers under the scheme, whereas the working holiday maker scheme is a free-for-all. Any employer can employ any backpacker. They don't need to worry about where they're living or about their welfare or anything like that.
No.
So the schemes are quite different in that sense, and that's both a positive in relation to Palm, but it's also a drawback because it makes Palm more expensive to use, requires a lot more effort on the part of the employer and so on.
But it took off after COVID. Why?
Well, it took off during COVID. And one thing that happened before COVID, and you talked about this in your introduction, and again, this was a coalition initiative. In 2018, and this, you'll recall at this time, Australia is struggling in its relations with the Pacific. China is looming large. And there was a foreign policy white paper that promised, this was under Turnbull, promised a step up in the Pacific. And what Australia offered the Pacific as part of this step up was instead of just these seasonal visas where people come for up to 9 months of a year to work in jobs like fruit picking, that we would offer a four-year visa. And this is what's called the long-term stream of Palm. Now, the four-year visa, as it was intended back in 2018, was really focused on jobs like aged care. The idea that, you know, we had shortages in regional Australia in aged care and other forms of disability support and so on, and that this would be a way both to meet those labour market needs and also to provide training and development for Pacific Islanders, Pacific workers. So that's the way it was conceived. But what's emerged from this long-term Palm scheme, the long-term stream of Palm, is the big employer is the meat industry.
Abattoirs.
There's 11,000 Palm workers working in meat processing. According to some calculations, I mean, the Australia Institute reckons it's one in four out of all meat workers are now on the Palm scheme. It's hard to get an exact figure, but Palm workers are now central, we can say that certainly, to employment in abattoirs and other forms of meat processing.
And it's in the abattoirs, is it not, that the main problems of employment are arising?
No, not just. I mean, there are problems, but there are also problems in the horticultural sector as well. So you do get the problems of workers, in both cases, workers being put in overcrowded accommodation and charged quite a lot for the privilege of sharing a room, sleeping in a bunk bed and sharing the room with three other people, and having no privacy and nowhere to store their possessions, and a long walk to the shower, which they have to queue up for after work because there's not enough showers for everyone, and you've just spent 12 hours, you know, picking peaches or whatever, and you're hot and sweaty. So the problems are in both sectors. But I think there are specific issues, specific problems when you bring someone from their home country for 4 years as opposed to 9 months. The seasonal workers are at least going home, spending at least 3 months a year with their families, able to go back and, you know, build the houses that they've saved up to build and all that sort of thing. whereas the meat workers or the long-term palm workers are separated from their families for 4 years at a time, and there is no intended pathway to permanent residency. So it's not a step to settlement. They might go back after 4 years, and after 6 months they can apply to come again. So they might end up being here for 8 years.
And without their families.
Without their families. There is important to note, there's a small trial underway for about 200 families to accompany palm workers to Australia and stay with them. But and apparently that, from what I've been able to gather, that pilot is going quite well. But we're seeing some interesting things happen. Some couples have chosen for the partner to come and join because they can work in Australia too. In fact, they can work anywhere they like. They don't have to work for the palm scheme. But they've chosen to leave the kids behind because, of course, how much money can you save if you're supporting kids in Australia as well? And, you know, it's harder to find appropriate accommodation and more expensive. So people make pragmatic decisions, and they might leave the kids behind with grandparents or aunties and uncles while they come. So you're getting a different kind of family separation emerging there as well. The Labor Party promised prior to its election in 2022, it promised that palm workers would be able to bring their families. This pilot runs till 2027. It's a highly supported pilot, so it's a bit, in my view, a bit artificial of what things would really be like. But we'll see, I guess, after 2027, whether that promise is realised and workers can actually bring their families with them.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to that familiar voice, Peter Mayers, about the PALM scheme, Pacific Australia Labour Mobility. Peter, I note in your report that at the moment, every fortnight, a welfare manager is supposed to talk to every worker. Have I got that right?
That's right. They're supposed to have...
So there's supposed to be an interview.
Not an interview.
Sorry.
There's supposed to be a meeting between the... So to explain a bit more background, an improved employer has to appoint a welfare officer to look after the welfare of their palm workers. And one of their jobs is every fortnight to meet with the workers. So it's not necessarily a one-on-one meeting. It's probably a group meeting.
So why doesn't this solve the problems that your report has identified for the workers?
Well, I think the big problem that the workers have, the biggest problem, is that they're tied to their employer. So your visa under PALM is a visa to work for one particular employer. Now, if you are having problems, you're being exploited at work or, you know, abused, or the accommodation's terrible, or you think your deductions aren't right, the first thing you should do, of course, is talk to your welfare officer or talk to your employer. But many workers are reluctant to do that for a range of reasons, cultural reasons sometimes, you know, questioning authority, but also they know that this employer has the right to send them home or to say, well, you're not coming back again next time. If it's a seasonal visa, we don't want you back next year because you've complained too much. And so the problem is that although there's a lot of supports in place, palm workers being tied to their employers makes it very hard for them to speak up. Now, there's a helpline through, a 1-800 number through the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations. But again, you know, do you have the confidence, as it were, as a worker who's come from a village in Tanna Island in Vanuatu, to ring this number and talk to someone you've never met and tell them, what's going on for you? So there are various supports, and they work. You know, so another support the workers have are what is called country liaison officers. So these are people employed by the sending country government, so by Fiji or by Kiribati or by Solomon Islands, and their job is to support the workers and check on them. But they're incredibly overworked because these workers are scattered all over Queensland and New South Wales and Victoria, so big distances between them. And the country liaison officers vary, is my understanding, in their approach. Some are really committed to the workers' welfare. Others see themselves as more like disciplinarians enforcing, order amongst and making sure that workers don't sleep around or that sort of thing, you know, have affairs when they're married and don't drink too much. And, yeah. So, you know, you get a very different sort of, different sorts of responses and different sorts of levels of support or whatever.
So the basic problem, as you see it, is that these workers are tied to an individual abattoir, an individual nursing home, an individual farm. Why have those employers been given this extraordinary power over their workers?
Well, I think that, I mean, this is one of the real problems of low-skilled temporary migration schemes, right? You bring people in to do dirty, dangerous, demeaning and difficult jobs that locals don't want to do because the wages aren't attractive enough or the conditions aren't attractive enough or they're too far away from the city or all those sorts of things. You bring workers in to do those jobs, and if you said, but you can actually go anywhere in the labour market, they wouldn't stay. Like everyone else, they'd leave and go somewhere else where they got better paying conditions. So in one sense, the tying is ensuring that these jobs get filled. There's also, I mean, I think some of the arguments for tying the workers are probably, let's say, paternalistic, like you want to make sure they're with a good employer. So as I say, the employers have to be approved. And so there's some level of regulation and control. And I understand that, you know, there's a reasonable argument there. And employers can trade workers. So an employer so can say, well, I've only got 8 weeks' work. And the palm workers have to be guaranteed, and this is a really good base level that the Albanese government brought in. They have to be guaranteed at least 30 hours a week work over the course of a month, so 120 hours a month. So they have to be guaranteed enough money to be able to they'll have money to send home to their families and pay their rent and their costs in Australia. Mm. Having said that, you said they're tied to an individual employer like an abattoir or a farm or a nursing home. In fact, most of them are tied to an individual employer, which is a labour hire agency. So there's about 111 labour hire agencies and about two-thirds of workers approved in the scheme and about two-thirds of the palm workers are employed by these labour hire agencies. So from my point of view, why not, as a first step, let workers move between labour hire agencies? That would increase competition. We all love competition, don't we? It would improve productivity because the workers would go where their skills are most used and valued, and they would have some agency to say, well, I'm not staying here where I'm sleeping in a bunk bed in a room with six other people and I don't understand the deductions from my wages.
Let's take a deep breath and look and take a look at how the scheme can work. And you have got a wonderful example of a nursery near Griffith.
Yeah, so this is Mossmont Nursery. So they grow, they're the start of the orchard industry, the fruit industry, if you like. They grow the trees that get sent then to orchardists to grow almonds and
I think they're called peaches. Saplings, Peter.
Yeah, saplings or bare-rooted saplings, indeed. And so I visited this place where they employ, I think, about 70 seasonal workers from memory, mostly from Timor-Leste and Vanuatu. And the workers I chatted to, now, admittedly, they were at work, but the boss was very good. He said, I'm going to go away so you can talk to the workers on their own and that sort of thing. They were incredibly enthusiastic about working in Australia, the money they were making, the changes they could bring about in their homes. So things like not just better houses for themselves and paying their kids' school fees, but, for example, Johnny Suarez, one man I met from East Timor, he was supporting his sister to study to become a health worker. He was supporting his brother to study engineering. He'd built a house for his parents. He'd been to Australia 8 times. He'd built a house for himself. He'd built a house to rent out. So the difference this can make in lives is extraordinary. And people talk quite movingly about, well, I've got to suffer the loneliness and the distance from my family and the cost. I bear this because of what I can do for my family. And family has a very extended sense, of course, in the Pacific. So, you know, in that sense, they felt they were well treated. They felt they were respected at work. And the employer said this is great. This is so much more productive than in the old days when I used to have backpackers, because the backpackers would do their 88 days and then he'd say, you know, they didn't want to stick around in cold old Griffith because his peak season's winter. They'd be off to the beach, up to Queensland or wherever, as soon as they got their second
bastards,
visa.
Bastards. They just use this country.
Yeah,
you know?
imagine people being able to choose which jobs they work in, David.
Or when to go swimming.
Exactly. And he said, you know, he's got the same workers coming back year after year and they do product control. They know which saplings are no good and they chuck them out. They don't send dodgy product out to growers. So, you know, he's a big fan of the scheme.
Peter, I've just received a correction. They're seedlings, apparently, not saplings. I'm terribly sorry. I'd like to apologise to all horticulturalists out there.
I'm going to call them bare-rooted fruit trees because that's what they look like to me.
But fair enough. And that sounds like the kind of thing you'd put in a report. Look, one of the things that you put, one of the recommendations you have in the report truly shocks me, which is that they be given access to Medicare.
What, you're shocked that they should get that or you're shocked that they don't have it already?
That they don't have it.
Yeah, well, no temporary visa holders get access to Medicare unless they're from Britain or a country with a reciprocal arrangement. So they are expected, or they are required, I should say, to pay for private medical insurance. And to me, this is wrong. Now, the PALM scheme is promoted as a win-win scheme. So it's a win for Australia in terms of filling lots of jobs, and it's a win for the Pacific in terms of improving the lives of Pacific peoples. And if that's an aim, then why aren't we giving healthcare to the workers who are here, enabling them easily to get healthcare? And it's also a false economy to deny them Medicare, because what happens is people are reluctant to go to the doctor. They're reluctant to seek healthcare, so they go at the last minute or only when they get really, really sick and an illness has progressed to a serious stage and then they end up in ICU. So it would make much more sense, in my view, to enable PALM workers to access Medicare. They're paying taxes. They're contributing to the economy. Why not enable them to access Medicare as well?
What are the other main recommendations you make?
Well, as we've already talked about the idea that people should be able to change jobs more easily, there's also real problems with the superannuation scheme. So workers pay into a superannuation fund, as all workers are required to do, but it's very hard for them to get that money. So when they leave Australia, they can't apply to get their super out until they're out of Australia, which means doing it long distance without support but they have to have a bank account in Australia still. They have to prove they've left Australia, all sorts of...
Yes, all that stuff.
All that stuff. But what's more is then they get their money and they lose 35% of it in tax because they're taking their super out early. Why are they taking their super out early? Because they have to, because they can't stay in Australia. So, we're penalising them. And again, if this is meant to be a program to advance the well-being of Pacific peoples as one of its aims, and only one of its aims, then allowing them to access their super, all of their super, without taxing it would seem to me to be a no-brainer.
But you have no doubt that the scheme should continue.
Well, let me put it this way. Pacific Islanders want the scheme. The workers who are here want to keep coming. There are plenty of other Pacific Islanders who would like to have the same opportunity. There are employers who think the scheme is great. I didn't meet anyone who said this scheme is a bad idea. The arguments are really, no one who's deeply engaged with it anyway, the arguments are about how do you make it work well without over-regulating it? Because, of course, if it's too cumbersome, too expensive, employers won't use it. They will use backpackers or undocumented labour. So we have to find that balance between regulating in a way that means that workers are respected, treated well, paid proper wages, not separated from their families for years at a time, but the scheme is also effective from an employer point of view.
Is there pressure from the islands supplying the labour to clean up these problems?
There is. You hear, if you read newspapers in Fiji and other places, Samoa and so on, you'll hear a lot of speeches by politicians talking about their concerns about the way their workers are treated in Australia. And there are other concerns too, particularly in countries that have sent a lot of labour to Australia and New Zealand. There's an equivalent scheme in New Zealand. So there are concerns, real concerns in Tonga, in Vanuatu, in Samoa, about the number of workers who've now gone overseas. And sometimes, it might be a nurse who's now who's come to Australia because she can earn so much more in aged care as an aged care assistant, well below her skill level, than she can as a nurse in Kiribati. Or a school teacher who can earn more in a meatworks in Australia than they could teaching school in a village in Fiji.
So we're bleeding essential workers from those countries.
That's the concern. And interestingly, Fiji is now importing workers from Bangladesh for some of the jobs where they've got labour shortages. It's migration, as you know, is a complex and fascinating area. And other things that happen, for example, in Tonga, there's a ferry company. Inter-island ferries are very important. And they're now employing women as ferry captains or forklift drivers, whereas women didn't do those jobs before. But because so many men are in Australia, now women are getting the opportunity to do other jobs than maybe would have been expected previously. So there's a plus. That's the thing. It's not all good and it's not all bad. It's complicated. It's interesting. And I think that when you ask me, should the scheme continue? Well, if we listen to voices from the Pacific, they would say yes.
Peter, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Peter Mayers, Adjunct Senior Research Fellow at Monash University these days, about the report he's written for the Scanlon Foundation about the workings of PALM. You can Google it. It's up there, but be careful with your search terms. I just put in improving PALM, and I got a lot of advice on growing PALM trees. Best to use the full title, Improving PALM, the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. This is Late Night Live. Coming up next, is the gay revolution in danger? Growing up in Ireland, Ronan McRae watched the world change for gay men like him and me. In 2015, Ireland did what once seemed impossible, defied the church to vote strongly in favour of gay marriage. The old order was done. But a decade later, worried by what he calls an anything-goes approach to sex, gender and sexuality, Ronan has published The End of the Gay Rights Revolution, How Hubris and Overreach Threatened Gay Freedoms. Certainly threatens gay funding. Google and Meta are no longer backing Mardi Gras. And that being a week away, we thought it was time to discuss the worries of Ronan McRae, author and teacher of constitutional and European law at University College London. Ronan, welcome to Late Night Live.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks, Dave.
Ronan, gay freedom has always had its enemies. None of these votes have ever shut them up. They keep beavering away. What evidence is there that they are making headway?
Well, there's a few individual bits of evidence, and then a broader trend. A lot of opponents of gay rights think that gay rights, or the embrace of gay rights, caused kind of Sodom and Gomorrah. And actually, what I set out in the book is the other way around. Gay rights only came because straight sexual norms had changed. That with no-fault divorce, abortion, contraception, straight people established for themselves an approach to sex that was all about choice and individual freedom, and then had to be pushed reluctantly to apply that same paradigm to gay people. So you actually had no-fault divorce, contraception, all those things for straight people. And straight people changed the meaning of marriage from being a lifelong union focused on children to being about adults' relationship recognition. And it was that straight revolution that preceded the granting of rights to gay people. And the trends that drove that are changing. First, there's a change, particularly on the US, on the right. The right, under Ronald Reagan, people like that in the US, was very much small state right. Now, they weren't keen on gay rights, sometimes opposed them, but they had a shared vocabulary of individual freedom. That's now changed. And the right in the US now is all about what they call post-liberal J.D. Vance argument, which has gay rights as a key target. And 3 years ago, 56% of Republicans in the US were in favor of gay marriage. It's now 41% and falling. There's a trend within feminism. A lot of feminists now are wondering if the kind of anything goes approach of the sexual revolution has actually worked for women. We see things like the Me Too movement, things like that. There is much more jaundiced attitude to anything goes approach to sex. And then particularly in Europe, some of the demographic features that have helped gay rights to advance are declining. There's very high levels of migration and very large proportion of immigration comes from places in the world that are strikingly hostile to gay rights.
Now, Ronan, there's much to unpick there, but could I say, on the other hand, now these figures are a couple of years old, but they're from the Pew Research Center, which are wonderful people, and they showed at the end of 2023 support for gay marriage. UK, 74%, Canada, 79%, Australia, 75%, US, 63%. Now, they are big figures. And yes, there are signs in other surveys of some dropping away. But the dropping away on the general population surveys is small. It's 2 or 3%, something like that. Yes, the Republicans in the United States have become wedded to some pretty horrible ideas. Ideas on race, ideas on equality, and ideas on sex. But do they really constitute a threat to the fundamental reforms of the sexual revolution? I mean, can you ever imagine gay men in the United Kingdom or Ireland or America or Sweden or Australia facing prison again as they did for having sex?
I admit first that we're only at the start of a process. It's not tomorrow that we're facing repeal of gay marriage or recriminalization. If I said to you in 1990, do you think that gay marriage will be recognized across North America, South America, Australia, New Zealand, most of Western Europe? You would have thought absolutely not. And if I said to you in 1970, you wouldn't have said absolutely not. You would have said, what are you talking about?
No, I would have said maybe in Scandinavia.
Yeah. The gay rights movement, it's true, has had the cultural winds in its favor for the last 50, 60 years. But if you step back, homosexuality has been, tolerated to various different degrees, but it's generally been repressed. Gay people have generally been treated badly in almost all of Western, the history of Western culture. The exception is the recent blip that we've had 30, 40 years of tolerance, 10, 15 years of legal equality. Now, the only way you could think that that is invulnerable is if you have this end of history view, where you think that, oh, well, there's some kind of irreversible historical process, that after centuries and centuries of discrimination, persecution, that comes to an end, there's decriminalization, then there's employment protections, then there's gay marriage, end of story. But actually, history isn't like that. Nobody foresaw that a US president who refuses to accept the result of an election could be re-elected. Nobody saw countries like Hungary and Poland moving back towards being illiberal and undemocratic in significant ways. And the same is true of gay rights. Yes, the numbers are only edging down slightly, but actually that's a really big change because we've had 50 years in which there has been steady advance of acceptance of gay people. The fact that that is now turning is a really big development. Look what happened in the corporate turnaround on gay rights. 2021, 2022, all these companies in Silicon Valley, elsewhere, are all falling over themselves to say, oh no, this our support for gay rights and gay pride, it's about who we are. It's not a calculation of the way the wind is blowing. I never really believed that because I didn't see Goldman Sachs sponsoring floats in the 1980 gay pride parade. But what's really interesting is how quickly and shamelessly they switched.
Yes. Ronan, the love of money must never be underestimated. Isn't it a pathetic sight? All of those companies suddenly not only dropping, of course, support for the gay revolution, but support for fair employment practices, the proper consideration of employment of people who aren't white, the whole lot. I mean, it's just pathetic.
And it's not like they were kind of subtle, discreet supporters before. They wanted to make those events and parades all about them and their branding. And they were like, they were, you know, the star that made themselves the star of the show. And then the complete shamelessness of the Volt-Face or Facebook and all these people, just immediately the political wind turns, they dropped gay rights. And I think we'll see some of the same stuff with politicians. Why are politicians now pro-gay in most Western countries? And they weren't in 1980. Not because politicians now are more moral. It's because they follow the prevailing winds. And if those winds change, which I think they're starting to change, that is going to change again. One of the statistics in the book that I think stops most people in their tracks is the fact that in the UK, the most anti-gay region of the UK by a distance is London. And, you know, large-scale population changes have large-scale impacts. Some good, and then some, at least from the perspective of gay people, not so good. More people in London now think that homosexuality should not be accepted than in any other region of the UK, including all the places that people previously thought of as very conservative, even like Northern Ireland. So, things do change. And if we think that politicians are going to stick by us in a way that corporates didn't, I think we'd be badly mistaken.
But Ronan, we're familiar in this country with the core political truth that new arrivals to Australia are socially conservative and, on the whole, don't approve of gay marriage, gay freedom, etc., etc. That is something that they have come to in a new country and it disturbs them. But that is a political challenge because the nation overwhelmingly does support those freedoms. And those freedoms can't be whittled away because there are some demographics that find them uncomfortable. You live with those critics. You don't buckle to them.
Well, it depends on which way the numbers are going. We can see from the data in the UK and in France that what happens is not merely that newcomers tend to have conservative views, it's that into the second and third generations, those views, particularly in relation to homosexuality, actually in relation to homosexuality more than any other issue, there remains a large gap.
They survive.
Very good book.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and get even stronger. So in France, it showed that the most conservative generation of Muslims are those born in France.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Ronan McRae about his book, The End of Gay Rights Revolution, How Hubris and Overreach Threaten Gay Freedom. Ronan, despite all of these votes, the institution that most governed the politics of gay punishment were the churches. And if Australia is any guide to this kind of thing, the public had long wanted an end to the criminalisation of homosexuality. But the church's grip on politics meant that it took a long time to be achieved. Now, the churches are still working, are they not? They haven't changed their ideas. We are to go not only to hell, but to jail.
I mean, partly. So there's a real difference. You see, in some of the Christian denominations, the Anglican tradition in Nigeria and Uganda is very different from the Anglican tradition in the UK. It's also true that, like Pope Francis said, well, homosexuality is a sin, but it shouldn't be a crime. That's not shared internationally by all of the bishops. But I think it's true that organized religion in general has been a drag on the acceptance of gay rights. And one of the problems that liberal secularists have is a demographic problem. Liberal secularists have the lowest birth rate of anywhere. And you think, oh, that sounds very alarmist. But long term, that makes a difference.
But Ronan, your solution to the problem appears to be for the gay community, and particularly gay men, to court respectability. But isn't respectability an endless trap?
Well, I think that one of the main things I'd say about the book, in the book, is that the political fate of gay people is a tragedy. What is tragic is that we are always a minority everywhere, and actually a very small minority. Even if you go to San Francisco, it's like 85% straight. We are a minority that in all places, at all times, has to constantly be pitching to the straight majority for our freedom. We're a tiny minority everywhere, relying on the straight majority's tolerance. And it'd be nice if we could just have our own fate in our hands and do what we wanted, but we can't. And that means we have to think, what is our political offering to the straight majority? Right from the early 70s and the early gay rights movement, there's been two different approaches. One has been to see gay rights as part of this, just one part of a general revolutionary overturning of all norms of family, sex, gender, etc. And the other has been to say, no, no, we just need reform. The point of gay rights is to stop gay people being persecuted, to allow them to have their relationships recognized, and that's it. And I think that latter approach is much more sustainable. That if our pitch to the straight majority is accommodating us requires you to change all existing norms around family, sex, and gender, the answer will be no. More and more moderate conservatives will see gay rights as a key thing for them to oppose. And unfortunately, in recent years, I mean, we saw in the 1990s, the movement moderated a lot, focused on things like employment protections, relationship recognition. Since mid-2010s, there's been a radicalization again. It hasn't been gay rights, it's been LGBTQ plus rights. And that, unfortunately, has made our opponents' case for us. Because our opponents say these people want to destroy all of the established norms that many millions of people treasure around family, sex, and gender. And if we say, for instance, think of the symbol plus. The LGBTQ plus Center of New York says plus stands for sexual orientations and gender identities that language cannot yet describe. So if our pitch to the straight majority is accommodating us requires changes that are so extensive that they need a mathematical symbol plus to represent gender identities and sexual orientations that language cannot yet describe, that is a disaster. That is exactly what gay rights opponents have been telling people. Accommodating these people requires you to change everything.
But Ronan, the gay community is not forcing that on the straight community. I mean, you are not a fan of promiscuity and you've got some very alarming material in your book about sexually transmitted diseases, which I think are sexually transmitted by heterosexuals as well as homosexuals, of course. But however gay men and women want to order their lives, what their sense of family, their sense of how they order their relationships, it's not being forced on anyone else.
Well, there's two things. So first, I mean, I don't think there's anything morally wrong with people having lots of sexual partners, and I'm not saying I've lived any perfect life myself in any way. But what I do think is, first, it is a political danger for us. Think of the plebiscite referendums like you had in Australia or legislative campaigns for gay marriage. Those ads did not show swinger couples who are throuples or, you know, leather, whatever. They showed what appeared to be, at least, monogamous, kind of traditionally straight adjacent couples. And why did they do that? Well, because gay rights groups correctly realized if we wanted to win, we had to reassure the straight majority that recognizing, for instance, same-sex marriage did not mean that there were no norms around monogamy or anything anymore. We know that that is a vote loser for us. And then also,
but Ronan, it's also true of large sections of the gay and lesbian community that they live in settled relationships that are monogamous and loving. And yes, I mean, some don't, some do. I mean, it's not a lie.
Well, there's nothing morally wrong with it. I mean, it's true that amongst male couples, levels of non-monogamy are much higher. Nothing morally wrong with that. I do think that having asked for admission to an institution that we knew to be monogamous, it's incumbent on gay people not to publicly flout that. Now, people can do what they want privately.
Monogamous heterosexual marriage. It's taken a bit of a battering over the years.
But the other thing is, I think that if you look, even from the mid-70s, there's a guy, Marty Levine, who wrote the first account, sociological account of kind of gay communities of gay male men in cities in the US. And he pointed, and all his interviews said, oh yeah, I'm having a great time, having loads of sex, but you know what I really want is a boyfriend, and I only ever seem to have one-night stands. And, you know, it's not that nobody is made happy by having loads of sex, but I do think that there is quite strong evidence that very high numbers of sexual partners is a health risk, but also beyond that, it is inconsistent with what most gay people tell they want pollsters they want in the long run. The vast majority of people, when asked, say they want monogamous or near monogamous settled relationships. Many fewer people are in those relationships. Now, that's not only, there's many reasons for that.
But Ronan, this is true of men and women. It's whatever their sexuality.
But it's long more true of gay men.
Many are unable to have the long-term relationships they want. I mean, perhaps this is more so for gay men. But I come back to the point, Ronan. This way of life is not being forced on anybody else. It's a leave us alone. We are not out there evangelizing for the destruction of the institution of marriage. Indeed, we campaigned for that institution to be extended to the gay and lesbian community.
So I think not forcing anyone, absolutely. But I do think there is a problem, a political problem for the gay rights movement, if gay freedom is seen as being synonymous with anything goes. And maybe morally that's nothing wrong with that. But it is the case that we are politically dependent. And the perception that accommodating gay rights is synonymous with anything goes approaches to sex will be, in an increasingly conservative society, a political problem. And the data suggests, I think, that it doesn't fully work for gay men anyway. I mean, lesbians are different because lesbian sexual culture is quite different from gay male sexual culture. If this culture was making people very happy, it was getting them to where they want to go long term, maybe it'd be worth going to the wall to defend it. But it's not.
Now, this is really, Ronan, this is really interesting. You're looking at the gay community, let's just say gay community of gay men, and saying it's unhappy.
On average, it is much more unhappy than other groups. The higher levels of loneliness, mental health, alcoholism, drug abuse. And, you know, there's many reasons for that. I'm not saying it's all down to...
So they should find a woman and marry them?
No, find a man and marry. No, I think people should do whatever works for them. But if we look at the overall pattern, what we're doing now is not working for more people than it's working for. And it's therefore, I think it would be better, no coercion, nothing, but I think it'd be better if, for instance, young people were given a message that is less that... Well, if you're gay, anything goes. Whatever you want to do sexually, go for it. If you want to follow your desires, don't question them. I think in most things in life, doing what your desires tell you in the individual moment is rarely a good idea in terms of getting where you want to go long term.
Ronan, as a gay man, do these gay men embarrass you?
That's a very good question. I wonder, it makes me very nervous. And that could be maybe because I grew up in a very homophobic society where gay sex between men was illegal till I was 16 and where, you know, gay people had zero social status. It would have been the end of your career, your social life, if anyone knew you were gay. So maybe I have some kind of hypervigilance about that. When I see, for instance, gay pride parades, though, with people with their dicks out or assless chaps or, you know, things like that. My main feeling is this is not going to last. If this is what we're telling people our freedom means, we're going to lose it. Now, maybe I'm being hypervigilant because of the circumstances of how I grew up, but I think it's not, given that gay people have been persecuted for 99% of Western history, I don't think that is such an unreasonable fear to have. And I think if our message is this is what gay freedom looks like, the median voter is turned off. And we can't afford that. We are 3-4%. The message that I think will be a sustainable message is you can believe in most of the traditional structures that people have believed in for centuries. And with a minor tweak, you can accept gay people, allow us to participate in society.
But you seem to be saying, get back in the closet.
Not get back in the closet, but I mean, I do think actually that for whatever reason, it's not a scientific observation, but gay men are embrace privacy in discussing and their sex lives less than others. And I think that's good for anyone, because true freedom comes from doing things in private that you don't want to talk about. And I just think public sexuality and nudity is rarely a vote winner. And I think people should embrace privacy. Privacy is not the same as secrecy. It's not the same as shame. The fact that you do something in private that you don't want to discuss in public doesn't mean you're ashamed of it. It means it's private. And sex is private. And actually, most of the cases that have advanced gay rights in the courts, initially in terms of decriminalization, were about the right to privacy, not the right to equality. I mean, I think equality came later, which is a good thing. But actually, privacy is a good thing. And I don't think that means being in the closet. I remember seeing, and it was on some conservative political ad, footage of the kink leather festival in San Francisco. And the mayor was there saying how wonderful it is as people kind of whipped each other and stuff. And I thought, that's very kind of strange, because isn't the whole point of that, that it's meant to be kind of naughty in some way? And if the mayor is there saying, oh, good for you, you know, you whip each other in public.
It's pretty ridiculous, isn't it?
It seemed to really, it seemed like rebellion with parents' consent.
This flamboyance surely has to be read against centuries of inflicted shame. Yeah. And this is a way of saying all that crap about shame is over. Now, it may be extravagant, tasteless, often very funny, but it's a way of saying shame doesn't grip me anymore. And that's an important political statement.
Yeah, and I think people shouldn't be ashamed of being gay. But that doesn't mean you need to perform your sexual things in public, or engage in a degree of nudity that other groups don't. I mean, I think right in the book that it's not surprising that the gay rights movement became quite wedded to anything goes approaches. Because if the previous sexual rules told you that your whole sexuality was wrong, you should be ashamed, it's natural to be suspicious of all sexual norms. But it's just not the case that because society's previous approach to homosexuality, those rules were wrong, it doesn't mean that all rules or all norms that encourage us to question our desires, encourage us to think about what we want long term, not what we want tonight, I think they're not a bad idea.
Ronan, thanks so much for talking to us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Ronan McRae, who has written a warning tome. It's called The End of the Gay Rights Revolution: How Hubris and Overreach Threaten Gay Freedom. It's published by Polity. And that's the week, so it's Chatterbox time, named after our theme song, Chatterbox Rag, by Elena Katz-Chernin. Many of you may have heard her double concerto for violin and cello on ABC Classic FM over the weekend. What a mighty piece of music. Now, I'm being taken to task once again for, how can I put it, being wrong. Talking about the house at Pooh Corner the other day, I reckoned Kanga could be the first kangaroo to make its way into children's literature. Thank you, Fiona, for pointing out that Edward Lear's The Duck and the Kangaroo was published about 60 years earlier. Yep, a poem about a duck hitching a ride with a kangaroo to hop three times round the world. I'm still copying it for recommending spades as the best and neatest way to kill cane toads. But Christine added that if we're pursuing ferals on the show, and we are, what about human beings? She wrote, I wish to make the point that humans do multiple times more damage to our planet than all the other feral species combined. An unanswerable point, but next on our list is feral camels. Another Christine suggested we take a look at Australia's failure to ratify the 2023 High Seas Biodiversity Treaty. It's a great idea, and we will next week. And that's it. Thanks, as always, to the team, Ali Benton, Alex Tai, Anne Arnold, and our leader, Catherine Sengra.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.